Well, if you have a Bible, I want to invite you to turn with me to Mark chapter 5. We actually touched on this story very briefly a couple of weeks ago. It was kind of lead up to the story of the woman with the issue of bleeding and then the Jairus's daughter and all that. That's at the end of Mark chapter 5. So we're going to go back to the beginning of Mark chapter 5. A couple of things here right off the bat. This is the most detailed story in Mark's gospel, aside from the crucifixion narratives. And so that's kind of significant because Mark, you compare him to Matthew or to Luke or to John, typically he writes very briefly. He has an economy of language, and so his accounts are very short. But with this one, there's something about this story that Mark feels compelled to draw out, to preserve, to pass on, and to do so in some detail. And so there's some significance here. Mark chapter 1, or chapter 5, verse 1. It says, they, that's Jesus and his disciples, went across the lake to the region of the Gerasenes. So Jesus and his disciples, they've just left this very small Jewish town called Capernaum. And that's, if you had to pick a place where Jesus had kind of his home base for his ministry up in the region of Galilee, that would be Capernaum. And they get in a boat and they go to the other side of the Sea of Galilee and they head for this region of the Gerasenes. I'll show you on a map here. Well, you can't see it very well, I don't have my pointer, but Capernaum is at the top kind of the Sea of Galilee, and then this whole section at the bottom right, you see in the very lower right-hand corner, it says the Decapolis. That's another name for the Gerasenes. Decapolis, deca meaning 10, and polis meaning city, right? You learned this at some point. So Decapolis, these 10 Roman cities that make up this region. And so the disciples are probably at this point, as they're in the boat heading southeast, going, why on earth are we going to this Roman, pagan, unclean territory where good Jewish people explicitly do not go? And as we said a couple of weeks ago, but this reminds me of it, so I'll say it again, Jesus doesn't seem to be bothered by, like, the clean, unclean kind of thing. He doesn't fear being contaminated by other people. And you realize for a Jewish person in the first century, like your social beliefs and your religious beliefs and your political beliefs and what your mama thinks, it's all the same thing. It's all one and inseparable. And so they know they're crossing these boundaries, and Jesus does not seem to pay attention to that or get hung up on that whatsoever. Verse 2, when Jesus got out of the boat, a man with an impure spirit came from the tombs to meet him. This man lived in the tombs and no one could bind him anymore, not even with a chain. For he had often been chained hand and foot, but he tore the chains apart and broke the irons on his feet. No one was strong enough to subdue him. Night and day among the tombs and in the hills, he would cry out and cut himself with stones. And then Luke, in his version, he gives the detail that this man has for a long time not lived in a proper house, and that he was completely naked. So people had repeatedly tried to chain this man up, kept on breaking the chains, the shackles, running around, screaming at all hours of the night, cutting himself with stones. It's kind of hard to relax on your back deck, isn't it? With this guy, you know, running around, hopping fences, tearing phone books, whatever. You realize there are no special homes, like in Palestine, for a person like this. There are no hospitals, no asylums. He lives among the tombs, like these caves, these holes in the ground. He's buck naked. He probably has scars on his wrists, on his ankles perhaps, where the chains or the manacles used to be. Is that a word, manacle? You know what I mean. I didn't know if I said like a pirate thing there for some reason, but he's possessed. This is not a funny story, so I'll get back on track. He's possessed by evil spirits, right? Giving him this cursed, like, superhuman strength. I mean, Mark is basically painting a picture of a man who's more, he's not even human anymore. He's more animal status than human. His humanity has been robbed. I mean, surely at one point he was some mother's little boy, right? Like running in the streets with other kids, building forts. His family has long been forced to give up on him. There's nothing that that they can do. And so how did he get to this place where his only home is a tomb? His only companions are demons. We're not told where, when, how this happened. We have no idea if at some point in his life he kind of gave ground and kind of opened up to some attack like this. All we know is somewhere along the way, sometime in the past, the forces of darkness gained a foothold in this man's life, and he's been a prisoner ever since. So Jesus and his disciples have just pulled their boat up on shore, and this man comes running out of the tomb, ranting and raving and foaming at the mouth, running toward them. The disciples, by the way, are still scratching their head from the last thing that just happened. In Mark chapter 4, crossing the Sea of Galilee, the storm comes up, the wind and the waves, and they think they're going to die. And Jesus, with a word, quiet, be still, calms the storm. And they're like, we've never seen a display of power like that. We've never seen anything like this. And so they're just trying to process that, and they set foot on dry ground, and then this man comes out. I'm assuming at which point they're backing up, right, pushing the boat back, we're out of here. When he saw Jesus from a distance, he ran and fell on his knees in front of him. He shouted at the top of his voice, think about that, "What do you want with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God?" It's interesting, there's no confusion on this man's part about who Jesus is. Now, the religious leaders, there's some debate going on, right? And for the crowds, we don't know, even some of Jesus' family are confused about Jesus. But there is no denying, for the forces of evil, Jesus' identity. "In God's name, don't torture me." For Jesus had said to him, "Come out of this man, you impure spirit." I find it a little bit ironic that the demon, we find out later it's plural, are saying, "Don't torture me," which is exactly what they've been doing to this poor man for all these years. Then Jesus asked him, "What is your name?" "My name is Legion," he replied, "for we are many." And he begged Jesus again and again not to send them out of the area. Now, a legion, that's a well-known military unit for Romans. It's roughly 6,000 soldiers. And so the point of that is that this man is possessed by more than one evil spirit, not just one. I mean, this is a formidable regiment of evil. The man's humanity is so reduced, he can't even say his own name anymore. Evil is speaking for him. He's living like an animal, forced down this path of self-destruction. He doesn't have any memory of the past, I'm guessing. No hope for the future, just a torturous existence. Verse 11. A large herd of pigs was feeding on the nearby hillside. The demons begged Jesus, "Send us among the pigs, allow us to go into them." He gave them permission, and the impure spirits came out and went into the pigs. The herd, about 2,000 in number, rushed down the steep bank into the lake and were drowned. Those tending the pigs ran off and reported this in the town and countryside, and the people went out to see what had happened. Now, you can actually go to this region today. There are several places where the rocks, the cliffs, kind of come up right up to the edge of the Sea of Galilee. And so the demons go into these pigs, and they rush down immediately, you know, over the edge and drown. Now, I have a lot of questions about this story. You know, why the pigs and what happens? What happens after that, for one thing? And are we supposed to feel sorry for the pigs? I kind of do a little bit. I mean, if you just imagine being there, that would you would remember that, right? It would be a pretty disturbing thing to actually see, and the noises that would be associated. It would be pretty shocking. And I imagine if it were like kittens or bunnies, we'd feel, everybody would be more outraged by this. But 2,000 pigs drown in the sea. I mean, that's an economic hit, a pretty big one for somebody. I think a lot of times Jesus acts in a way. I mean, Jesus does things to reveal truth that everybody else had missed. In this case, Jesus' encounter with these evil spirits and then what happens to them, I think it reveals in a pretty dramatic way what these spirits had been trying to do to this poor man all along, but had been unable to do. And then suddenly they find themselves in a weaker host, as it were, and they have no problem at all fulfilling their destructive desires. Verse 15, when they, the people of the town who saw all this, came to Jesus, they saw the man who had been possessed by the legion of demons sitting there, dressed and in his right mind, and they were afraid. Those who had seen it told the people what had happened to the demon-possessed man and told about the pigs as well. Then the people began to plead with Jesus to leave their region. I mean, Jesus heals this man, a healing that covers lots of dimensions. He's now dressed. Perhaps the first time in a really long time. Who knows how long? He's sitting there calmly. There's no longer a need to chain him down. His thoughts are coherent. He knows his name. We find out in a minute that he has a family, a home. He's free from self-destruction. He's fully human again. And then we see the townspeople who see this, and they're afraid, not of the demons, not of things that you would think you'd be afraid of. They're actually afraid of the deliverer. They're afraid of Jesus. And I think it's interesting that the townspeople plead almost as urgently as the demons pleaded to go into the pigs. You know how you have the townspeople pleading urgently for Jesus to be the one to go. It's a tragedy. I mean, Jesus is standing on their shore with the power to cast out demons, the power to heal, the power to speak of the kingdom, the good news, and they beg him to leave. I think because this herd of pigs was more valuable to them than this man. It's interesting that Jesus never stays where he's not welcome. We don't want you here. We don't want your kind around. Go. And so Jesus says, okay, if that's what you want. And he turns and to get in his boat and to leave. Verse 18, as Jesus was getting into the boat, the man who had been demon-possessed begged to go with him. Now that phrase, with him, it's a very specific phrase in Mark to refer to discipleship. Two chapters earlier in Mark 3, it says Jesus appointed 12, designating them apostles that they might be with him, that they might follow him and take on this discipleship role to Jesus. In Mark chapter 1, Jesus calls the first four disciples, Peter, Andrew, James, and John. And what does he call them to do? He calls them to leave behind their business, their livelihood, their family, everything that's comfortable, everything that's familiar to them, to be with him, to follow him as disciples of Jesus. Which makes it fascinating to me that you have a man clearly expressing his desire to do all of that, to be with Jesus in the sense of, I'll follow you anywhere. He's begging, not just asking, he's begging to leave behind his home and his past and everything he's known to follow Jesus. Which makes what Jesus does next here seem very, very strange to me. Especially if you think about the fact that willing, dedicated, committed followers like this are kind of hard to come by. You go throughout the rest of the Gospels and it's like Jesus can't seem to find people who are willing to do this. They always have some excuse that prevents them. And here the man is saying, I'll do anything. And Jesus says, Jesus did not let him, but said, go home to your own people and tell them how much the Lord has done for you and how he's had mercy on you. So the man went away and began to tell in the Decapolis, the region of the Gerasenes, how much Jesus had done for him. And all the people were amazed. Now, one of the big level things, I think, if you just take one step back in Mark's gospel that Mark is showing us, is that Jesus is Lord over everything. You see in chapter 4, he commands the wind and waves to be still, and the chaos and the storm obeys him. So he's Lord over these chaotic natural forces. And then in Mark chapter 5, 1 through 20, clearly Jesus is Lord over these personified forces of evil. And then later in the chapter, he's Lord over sickness, and then ultimately even Lord over death as he raises Jairus' daughter. Now with the other stories that we've looked at in this series, for me it's been a little bit easier personally to kind of put myself like in the position of the person. That always takes work to put yourself in someone else's shoes, but with these other stories I've been able to do that, I think, a little bit better or easier. I don't know anyone who reads this story and goes, man, I relate to that guy, right? I just see a lot of myself in him, right? No, I mean, the possessed by evil spirits, superhuman strength, running around howling like a madman, naked, that's really relatable, isn't it? No, not at all for most of us, I hope. And so I want us to focus on the last few verses of this account. There is a part of this story that I really connect with, and it's one of the reasons I love this story. This man, we see him restored, and he begs to go with Jesus, and Jesus says, nope, go home. Go to your own people. Stay here. Tell what the Lord has done for you here in this place. Now, I want to be really careful not to overly like universalize this, and so I'll just say up front that you may not connect at all with what I'm kind of taking from this. But I'll tell you what this says to me and why I've gone back to this many times over the past few years. Maybe some of you will find this helpful and you'll relate to this as well. We've currently, in our small group, we've been telling our stories as a group and getting to know each other. We're kind of a newer group. And Liz and I, we got to go first in telling our story, and you just talk about your life and share what you want to share, and it's not like a big deal. But one of the themes that clearly emerges as we've kind of practiced this, and we've done this a couple times now, one of the themes that emerges in both of our stories is a love of travel, like a love of adventure. I mean, we've had lots of opportunities to travel internationally and to go to different cultures, and you know, my passport's full, isn't that exciting? And they had to stamp like 26 extra pages stapled to the middle of my passport because I filled it up, and you know, just a pat on the back for me. But I feel like I come alive in those interactions, like something about it, the adventure of it, the excitement of new places, new things. Last year, Liz and I got to go to Panama, not City Beach, Florida, but Panama in Central America. That's a place? Yes. And we went there for our 10-year anniversary, and I just was like consciously aware, and this is hard to do, the entire time of how much I was just enjoying every moment. Like the color schemes are different, and the plants are different, and the smells are different, and even I like the, there was like certain beaches that had like these invisible biting like bugs, and they hurt real bad. I like that because I was like, at least it's something different. You know what I mean? I like that experience. I love all of it. One of the things that I do to torture myself, I guess, I love reading books and blogs and magazines about sailing. I'm fascinated by people who circumnavigate the globe in a sailboat. That makes no practical sense whatsoever for where I actually live, like 1,000 miles from the nearest ocean or so. For someone who's sailed 2 times in my life, I have a remarkable arsenal of knowledge about sailing facts and useless things about trade winds routes and types of boats and anchors and just a vast amount of theoretical knowledge about this totally impractical subject for me. I know, it's weird. I just love that sense of adventure and just out there in the world. Liz and I were talking recently because spring break's coming up for our kids, and I just said to her, let's just go somewhere. Let's just drive. And she's like, okay, where? And I was like, I don't know. I don't care. Let's just get in the car with the kids. And if we have to pick a direction, let's pick south. That makes the most sense to me. And let's just go somewhere. I love several lines in Jack Kerouac's book, On the Road. One of them, he says, our battered suitcases were piled on the sidewalk again. We had longer ways to go, but no matter. The road is life. He goes on. He says, I was surprised as always by how easy the act of leaving was and how good it felt. The world was suddenly rich with possibility. Now, I can point to, like, weaknesses in his philosophy, perhaps, but I cannot deny this fierce sort of quest for meaning and belonging expressed on, you know, through life on the road. There's something very, very appealing to me at a deep level. Here's the thing, though. Like many of you, I've lived long enough to know that living my life just for the sake of adventure, just for the sake of excitement and travel, I know in my head that that's not a big enough thing to give my life to. I mean, collecting stamps and the passport's fun. Ultimately, that's not fulfilling for me, at least. I know that the gospel of the kingdom invites us to give our lives away, to be part of something bigger. And I know this, and I want my life to be like that. So here's what I do. So then I find Christians who are doing all these amazing things for the kingdom, right? So now it's like kind of mission and it's kind of gospel and kingdom related. And so they're starting orphanages and feeding hungry people and starting up churches in closed countries, and they don't know where their next meal is going to come from, but they pray and they trust God and he provides. And they have all these amazing stories. And I hear about people traveling around the world, learning these interesting languages and going to dangerous places for the gospel and getting interviewed on Hezbollah TV. You remember Carl sharing last week. And that's all good. But it raises this kind of annoying question. What am I doing with my life? What the heck am I doing with my life? I'm asking if anybody has any feedback. My wife and I have spent almost 11 years in Muncie, Indiana. We have precisely 2 kids, a fancy dog. we have a nice house, if average. Our kids go to good schools. I go to work every day in an office where you don't have like those old-fashioned metal keys. You have this really cool key fob that you just hold up, beep, to like doors and they open. Even saying a word is pretentious as fob. Like I should be punched for that. I get my hair cut every other Friday at 11 a.m. If you think this just happens by itself, you're crazy. I work out regularly. I gotta try to preserve this body. If I told you my to-do list, what I have to do that I'm procrastinating right now, we had a little meeting about the other day, you would be bored to death. And here I am in the midst of a very ordinary life, trying to figure out how to follow Jesus and make my small, ordinary impact for the gospel, for the kingdom. But you can probably see how for a guy like me, from time to time with Liz or my close friends, I have these kind of exciting moments of existential crisis. What am I doing with my life? And some of you are probably depressed just hearing me talk about this, right? Like you're going, okay, thanks for sharing, because now I know I don't want to end up like that, right? I get it. That's fine. Go for it. My guess is, though, I'm not the only one here who occasionally wonders about these things. Like we wonder sometimes, am I missing out on a better life somewhere else? We're kind of restless in our relationships, our surroundings, our jobs. We wonder if we picked the right major, if we bought the right house, if we married the right person. Do not read into that last one. I'm not talking about me. What kind of fool would I be, right? No, but seriously, we wonder, are we doing what we're supposed to be doing with our lives? Or is it possible that somewhere along the way we've settled, we've conformed, we've given in for, we've traded something for this average existence? With our Odysseys and our Outbacks and our Yukons parked safely in the driveway. Get it? Jesus heals this man in Mark 5 in a very dramatic way. And the man's first response is to want to get in the boat. Jesus, let me go with you somewhere else. Anywhere else, really. I mean, somewhere where you're doing more exciting things like this. Anything but like ordinary life here. I want to go on this adventure doing awesome things. He's putting a leg over the boat, begging to go with Jesus. And he says, go back home. Tell how much God has done for you here. That's not what he wanted to hear, is it? It's not what he wanted to hear. And I'm just saying that the word stay, and this is important, the word stay is a very hard word to hear for disciples who are eager to follow Jesus anywhere, as long as we don't have to stay put. And Peter, James, and John, they get to leave. Matthew gets to leave his tax collector booth. Abraham, he really gets to go, doesn't he? He just packs it up. He doesn't even know where he's going. He just starts walking to the place God's going to, you know, show him at some point. Jesus says to this man, though, do you believe that the same power that healed you, do you believe that that power can sustain a life of faithfulness right here? That God can meet you here? That God can use you here? Can you trust me enough to stay? And the man does. It's amazing. Presumably, he lives a life of faith. And he goes and he tells his family what's happened, the people of his town, and ultimately, the people in these 10 Roman cities in this area. Now, just going back to our story real quick, and I normally don't like to talk about myself that much, but it is the story that I know best. We believe that God led us here to Muncie. I mean, it was safe to say that those years ago when we were processing all this, we tried to do everything we could to pretty much not be here while still remaining open. And I'm not saying that we heard God's voice. I wish that would be simpler. It wasn't like that. Just in a very ordinary way, we sensed that this is where we're supposed to be. And guess what? We haven't gotten any other direction since then. Is it possible that I'm deceiving myself? Yeah. Is it possible that I've conformed and settled? Yeah, I think about that like every single day. It's totally possible. The only thing is, I don't hear that. I don't sense it. And I kind of am expecting it is the weird thing. Kind of expecting to hear, what are you doing with your life? Shame on you. You know, all these things. And that's not what I hear. I'd feel better in some ways if that's what I heard. I have no idea what the future will hold. In the meantime, we just keep going with it, I guess. And by the way, this is not an anti-missions sermon. I think God does and is calling people to go and to do things in other places. Maybe you could even argue more people than are actually going and doing. I get that. That's not for me to know, and it's not for me to judge. But what I love about Jesus' word in Mark 5, this word to stay here. Amidst all the stories that we tend to hear, like the books that we kind of read and the blogs and guest speakers and people who have amazing stories, which, by the way, nothing against that. I find that to be very encouraging to me. And I welcome that kind of challenge, explicit or implicit, to look again at my life and what am I doing, and am I doing what I think God's calling me to do? I welcome that. But I bring all that up to say that this idea of just being faithful where we are, like being faithful with what we've actually been given, even the small things, that hardly gets any airtime, does it? Hardly ever. It doesn't sell books, you realize. Being faithful with the small things. It's underrated. And most of the time when you serve, for example, with your small group, or you serve in some area of the church, have you noticed nobody wants to interview you about that afterward? Nobody says, how was it serving food and changing the world at the soup kitchen, right? Nobody says, what was it like winding up sound cables? You know, tell me, that must have been exhilarating. You know, what was it like passing out animal crackers and how exciting to teach that lesson to three-year-olds upstairs about the Bible? Oh, it doesn't feel like that. And by the way, most of the time Jesus says, the kingdom of God advances almost always in very small, almost always imperceptible ways. Look at his parables. A couple weeks ago, my friend George, who mentors a kid through our Kids Hope program at Longfellow, and I've been doing that for several years, he invited me to take my Kids Hope kid to see the Lego movie along with his Kid Hope kid. And I checked into it with his mom, and I've mentored this kid. He's first grader now, Donnie. I've mentored him for 2 years. Before that, I mentored his older brother for 4 years, okay? And I bring all that up just to say that it's taken me 6 years now to build up enough trust with this mom to be able to call her up and to take her son, a first grader, to see this movie. And I don't blame her. You know what I mean? Some strange guy, you get it, right? But she said yes, and I took along our two kids just to have, look, I'm normal, you know, kind of thing. And so our two kids plus Donnie, that's three kids' tickets, my ticket plus popcorn drinks, some candy. I'm trying to explain to you how I spent $50 exactly on this, like, Saturday noon movie. Nothing could be more ordinary than just sitting in a theater with a kid, laughing at lots of jokes that went right over his head. You know, from time to time, I'd look down the aisle at George, like, we got that Danny Boy reference, you know. You know, I don't know what, if anything, of kingdom significance is going to come out of that relationship. While I'm being honest, I will say this. Every Tuesday for 6 years, I find that when it's time to go to Kids Hope, I'm, like, incredibly busy right at that minute. And, like, you know, you have to stop what you're doing and get the snack and go there, and it takes time out of my day. Many, many times I have this thought, maybe this time I should just text Maggie, who heads up. She teaches at Longfellow and heads up the program. Maybe I should just text her this week and just say, I can't make it. I'm kind of busy. He would understand, and, you know, I'll show up next week. And every week when I show up, I drag myself in there, and I leave. I'm like, I am so glad that I did that. So glad that I did that. I realize I don't have to be in charge of the results. I just have to show up. This week I was leaving Kids Hope. I was leaving the elementary school, and I wait for Donnie in, like, the front, like the airlock, you know, for his ride to pick him up. And we do this thing. There's all these kids. And it's kind of chaotic. And there's been this girl, like this third grader, who's been pretty outgoing, and she's been talking to me over the past weeks. She has, like, a very unique African-American name, and I tried with great deliberation to learn this name. And 2 weeks ago, we're standing there. She goes, do you know my name? And I was like, yes. And she does what, like, only kids would have the audacity to do. What is it then? And I said it, and she was surprised. I said, well, what's my name? And she didn't remember it. And I was like, all right, look, if you can remember my name 1 week from now, I will bring you Skittles, okay? And so this past Tuesday was the week, and that was her quiz. And we're in the area, the airlock area, waiting, and she doesn't show up. So she's not there this week, so I put the Skittles in my pocket. Donnie's ride picks him up. I'm heading out the door, and I notice there's this like little girl sitting on the floor with her hood over her face, and she's crying, and there's a teacher's aide standing next to her, and another kid very insensitively says out loud, "What's wrong with her?" And the teacher's aide says, "Oh, she's upset because somebody..." this all happens in 1 second. She's upset because somebody stole her candy. And I'm pushing on the door to leave, and I had the thought, "You dummy, you got candy in your pocket. You're just going to put it in your car till next week." And so I was like, "All right, I got to do this," which is what you would have done. And I took it out of my pocket, and I just went over to her and just kind of dropped it in her lap. And she didn't even look up. I mean, she didn't even see who it was. And then I walked out, and by the time I got in my car and drove past the front of the building, she was then standing outside, smiling, you know, holding up this bag of Skittles, showing her friend. That is my amazing, awesome, incredible story from this week, right? and that's not to say, look how great I am, because obviously any one of you would have done the exact same thing. I'm just saying sometimes this is as small as a package of Skittles. While we're talking ordinary things, a couple more. What could be more ordinary and nearly invisible than day-to-day, those of us who have kids or grandchildren, trying to model to the best of our ability what it looks like to follow and to love Jesus? Bob Goff tweeted this recently. If you want lasting influence in the world, influence your family. And I don't know about you, I'm just saying it doesn't feel like when I'm trying very, very patiently to teach my kindergartner to read by, you know, doing the homework from school and these incredibly mind-numbingly boring stories, and I'm trying as hard as I can to not say the word for him when he pauses for even a second. It doesn't feel like I'm doing anything. I just bring that up because maybe we're not alone in that. That maybe we're called to make a difference in small ways where daily faithfulness counts, where it matters. What could be more ordinary than engaging in Christian community? Getting together in small groups, sharing your story, trying to live out your faith. One of the annoying byproducts of staying, right, is that people get to see you at your worst, right? I probably shouldn't tell you this story. A couple years ago, there's a group of us from church, and we were in Turkey doing this video thing. I don't think I've said this. I think I would remember. And it was just the first 2 days were super stressful, and just filming logistics and travel things and just all these barriers and all these headaches. And we're tired because of the time difference, and so we're sitting at this cafe for dinner, which was an ordeal to even find a place. And we're sitting outside and just wanting to sit down. Have you ever felt like that? Like, I just want to sit down. And we're hungry, and we order our food, and there's these feral cats, like, climbing all over the table and doing all this stuff. And I was just kind of ignoring it. There were other people in our group that did not think that was okay, that were kind of grossed out by that. And so by the time our food came, there were a number in our party who couldn't eat, okay? And I thought they were just being babies and just grow up and quit being so rude and insensitive to this, you know, our host culture and all this stuff. And so have you ever snapped before? I have a couple of times. And after I, like, you know, come back to you, I like, what happened? So I just had enough, and all these things were built up, and I was like, I'm going to lose my, and I beep, you know, it starts with an S, and it's four letters. And so the dinner was very quiet after that, and we just sat there, and I went back to the hotel and just kind of moped around and went to bed early. And the next day, I did feel bad. I'm not proud of this. The next day, I apologized to the guys and said, "Look, I was out of line. Can you forgive me?" And they were very gracious. See, when you stay in a place, people know your habits and your shortcomings and your hang-ups, and we've got to figure out how to love each other anyway. All this to say, I don't know many of you. I don't certainly know many of your stories in detail. I have no idea what the future will hold for you. All I know is that you're here right now, for this time, for this season. And it may not be forever, but it could be for longer than you think. Are you being faithful with the small things, with what you've been given here and now. It's very, very easy for Christians especially to spiritualize our restlessness. And in the name of God and Him calling me, leading me, all these kind of mysterious, vague things, we can do anything. We can convince ourselves of anything. And I'm not saying that God doesn't do that. But we can often use that, our spiritualized restlessness, as an excuse to not engage, to not invest where we are. Just this morning I was thinking, there's a couple, Zach and Mary Kate, in the church, and he's just graduated, and they don't know how long they're going to be here. And he approached me, and we've been very intentional about meeting, and he started up this college-age discipleship group. Again, he may, a year from now, be in some other part of the world, but he's willing to say, look, I'm here now. I'm going to invest a little bit of time on Wednesday nights and just give back and serve and invest in other people's lives. And that's exactly what I'm talking about. So one of the lessons that I'm learning and have to keep reminding myself is that God many times doesn't let us get to the next thing, whatever that is, until we're being fully present, engaged, and faithful with what we have now. You know, in my very, very rare moments, when I stop worrying that I'm missing out on some great adventure for Jesus somewhere else, I actually have peace. I actually have joy. I don't hear, like, heavenly voices, but I have this sense that in my meager attempts to follow Jesus, to love Him, to love other people, to be faithful in the small things, and I get it wrong more than I get it right, that's what God is calling me to do. And and here's a word that we very rarely hear, that's enough. That's enough. Would you stand? We'll pray. Lord, thank you so much for your word, for the example of the story in Mark 5, this man's life. Father, we acknowledge that we have no idea where our lives are going to lead, what you're going to call us to do next. Kind of in that tension, and we hear what other people are doing, and we hear these amazing things, it's very easy for us to feel guilt, to have this sense of restlessness about what we're doing. And Lord, there may be somebody here who needs to hear, go. I'm calling you to go, and we're not going. But Lord, for many of us, I just pray that you'd help us to come to grips with the fact that you've called us to be here, at least for now, at least for this season. And help us, while it doesn't feel like we're changing the world or doing any amazing thing, help us to be fully engaged, be fully present. And if it's a package of Skittles or something else, Lord, just help us to be in that moment, to be the hands and feet of Jesus. And it's all about you anyway. It's all about your glory, and that's what it's always been about. So to that end, we pray that you would use us in big and maybe more often than not, small ways. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Well, thanks for worshiping with us this morning. Have a great week. Enjoy the sunshine, assuming that happens. Go with Him, and we'll see you next week.